The headlines, the International Atomic Energy Agency warns that Europe must take urgent action to avert a potentially dangerous natural gas shortage this winter. Iran says comments by U.S. President Joe Biden against Tehran during his recent visit to West Asia were a sales pitch to sham the apartheid regime. And thousands more people are evacuated from their homes in southwestern France as wildfires continue to rage in the region. Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisu Misha Ahmadi, and these are our top stories of this hour. The International Energy Agency warns that it is calling for a crisis over the looming gas crunch in Europe caused by reduced Russian supplies. The head of the IEA has urged European nations to take coordinated action to avert a potentially dangerous fuel crisis in the coming winter. The agency says that the continent faces a real possibility that Russia might completely halt its supplies. The move could force some governments into gas rationing. Europe has historically relied on Russia for around 40% of its natural gas, most delivered via pipelines. Russia has already shut down some of its pipelines, including Nord Stream 1, citing different pretexts. According to the IEA data, gas flows to the EU have fallen below 100 million cubic meters a day this month. Europe says that Russia is using energy as a political leverage against Western sanctions, an accusation that Moscow denies. Welcome to this edition of the News Review. In this edition, Iran has made a blistering attack on U.S. President Joe Biden over his latest rhetoric against the country's nuclear program.
Irony of our times. Just on the anniversary of the first U.S. nuke test, and after visiting an outlaw regime that possesses clandestine nukes, Mr. Biden stresses that he would not allow Iran to build bombs. Sales pitch to charm the Israeli apartheid regime by bombs that Iran has never sought.
Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani was referring to Biden's remarks during his recent West Asia tour that included a visit to Israel. Biden said in a meeting with the acting Israeli prime minister in Tel Aviv that Washington would use force to stop Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. He later repeated his anti-Iran stance in Saudi Arabia on the second leg of his regional tour. Iran has time and again rejected allegations that it is in the pursuit of nuclear weapons. However, the Islamic Republic has made it clear that any act of aggression against the country will be met with a crushing response. To continue this discussion, we're joined by Robert Fantina, author and journalist, who is joining us from Ontario, and also Said Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator from London. Let's begin with Mr. Fantina. Basically, in your opinion, why did the U.S. president have to make such anti-Iran comments, particularly mentioning that the U.S. is prepared to use force?
He's doing this, as you mentioned, to charm or to please Israel for reasons due to Biden's particular as every president in recent history has also done. He wants to give Israel everything that it wants. If Israel doesn't want Iran to have nuclear weapons, then Biden will prevent it. It's all to shore up his, to show that he supports Israel completely. Why he does this, why he supports an apartheid regime in violation of guilty of crimes against humanity is another unknown, but that was his purpose for doing so. It's more than ironic that the leader of the only country that's ever used nuclear weapons thinks it can decide who can and cannot have.
That is true. Said Mohsen Abbas, Iran, as a sign of goodwill, signed the nuclear deal back in 2015. There have been numerous reports from the IAEA saying that Iran has been complying with that deal. The U.S. in 2018 left the deal, and now it is accusing Iran. What do you make of this show?
Well, the truth is that the hypocrisy and the double standards of the Americans is so obvious that it barely is worth repeating over and over again. The world generally knows what the Americans are about. It's about the economic interests. It's about, as my colleague said, the interests of Israel primarily. And don't forget, there's also the challenge that they face on the surface, on the face of it. There is this so-called Eurasian axis, which is rising. So Russia, China, Iran being included within that is something that the Americans will argue that it compels them to actually have a stronger hand in West Asia. In reality, Saudi Arabia has actually been making noises, very positive noises for Russian support, and has also been very open to China. It could be argued, therefore, that Biden's mission, other than Israel, was also to secure and lock down Saudi Arabia. You know, Donald Trump talked about milking the cow, and milking Saudi Arabia is certainly something the Americans have been awfully good at over the decades, and they want to continue that until that oil runs out completely. So you could say that also Biden has been forced to try and bring Saudi Arabia back into his fold, because the Saudis have got the jitters. The fact of the matter remains that in Yemen, the Americans, aside from supplying the weapons to kill all the poor Yemenis via the Saudi direct campaign against that nation, they've actually done very little in terms of boots on the ground. And that's what Saudi Arabia is probably looking at, is to say that, you know, are we really secure? Can American defense systems really save us? Because the rise of drone technology, the rise of ballistic missiles in the region is all challenging them. And partly the Americans have also been bolstering up, in terms of nuclear hypocrisy, the possibility of the Saudis having their own nuclear weapons. It won't actually happen. If it did, it would be triggers in the hands of the Americans or the Israelis ultimately. But what they're doing is they're also trying to keep Saudi and the Gulf Arab states in line. And by trying to sort of pay lip service to the fact that they can put Iran under pressure with a military attack. It's highly irresponsible. It's really beggars belief that the Americans can use this kind of language, knowing full well the Islamic Republic of Iran has an arsenal of hundreds of thousands of its own ballistic missiles and can give as good as it gets, given that they failed in Syria, given that they failed in Lebanon, given that they failed in Yemen. How on earth do the Americans expect militarily to be able to bring the Islamic Republic of Iran under any kind of control, let alone Israel?
And as you mentioned, Iranophobia is now the main tool at the hands of the U.S. Mr. Fontina, if you could please shed more light on this whole Iranophobia project that the U.S. is pursuing and how it economically benefits from it.
Certainly. The U.S. is twisting the narrative. Now, U.S. news reports are talking about what can be done to bring Iran back into compliance to the JCPOA. No one's talking about what can be done to bring the United States back into compliance, and it's the United States that left initially. The United States wants oil. That's one of the reasons why Biden visited Saudi Arabia and was so cordial to leaders there, despite their atrocious human rights records, despite their assassination of Jamal Khashoggi a few years ago. The U.S. wants their oil. The U.S. would also like to have Iranian oil, too, but isn't going to buy it from the current government because it sees the Iranian government as the evil one, the enemy, and since Israel sees it that way, the United States will continue to do so. So if there is an invasion of Iran by the United States or Israel, which would be a disaster, as your other commentator mentioned, Iran is not a small, weak country with no allies. It would be a total disaster. But if the U.S. does invade, it wouldn't be to prevent Iran from interested in, it would be to get its oil. I do want to comment that while the Iranian government has said it has no interest in nuclear weapons, the fact that it's being threatened by two countries with major nuclear weapons may make the government reconsider that and feel they have a need to have nuclear weapons. So it could be that Israel and the U.S. are driving them to that and will then say, oh, look, Iran has nuclear weapons, we have to invade. So either way, it's the United States attempt to manipulate the situation for its own benefit, for power and profits and oil, which is what has always been important to the U.S. government.
Exactly, and as you mentioned, milking the cow. So, Mr. Abbas, if you could please tell us, how can the Arab nations and Arab leaders, for that matter, trust a person who doesn't even put enough effort to learn an Arab name? He couldn't even pronounce Shirin Abu Akleh's name correctly, or any other issues that the Arab world is now concerned about. How can they even trust the U.S.?
Well, because basically the whole of the infrastructure of these Gulf Arab nations is ultimately controlled by Western deep state, whether it's Israeli deep state or whether it's the Atlantic deep state nations. They're embedded so deeply inside the countries like Saudi Arabia and Kuwait. I mean, you'd have to be very naive not to think that actually the key area of energy interest for the West would be left alone to deal with its own affairs. People like Mr. MBS, you know, Mohammed bin Salman, yes, they're the puppets that get put up front and they get bolstered up, but the reality is their strings are pulled by these agencies in the background. There's been rumors that the CIA has fallen out with MBS, and there are other rumors to say Saudis are trying to shift over towards the Chinese and the Russians. In reality, these are all, I think, just part of window dressing. The truth is that the Zaire Western imperialists have had their talons inside these nations for a very long time, and they don't really have a great deal of say of how their policies are run. Look, Saudi Arabia invests something like $4 trillion in real estate in America alone. The Swiss bank accounts of these royal families are all held to ransom by Western banksters. The Saudis and these guys are essentially just puppets on strings, and they don't make the decisions, although they do go about doing what they're told to do. For instance, you know, Sisi has been running around, Egypt's leader has been running around trying to rally Bahrain and Oman, and others also are running around trying to rally this kind of Arab-style NATO defense thing against Iran. What they're better off doing is allying with the Islamic Republic of Iran, creating a stronger regional alliance, which actually puts Israel and America in check, because they're the illegitimate protagonists and oppressors in the region. It's not Iran.
Thank you very much. Sayed Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator from London, and Mr. Robert Fantina, author and journalist from Ontario. Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen for sharing your thoughts and views with us on this edition of the News Review. And thanks to all of you viewers for following us. Moving on, as Iran prepares to host a meeting on Syria as part of the Astana peace process, the Iranian foreign minister has laid out the agenda of the talks. That includes the return of Syrian refugees and the restoration of peace, security, and stability to the war-torn Arab country. Hussein Amir Abdullahian says the meeting will reaffirm the main objective of the Astana format, namely reducing tensions in conflict zones in Syria. As such, he says, the talks seek to resolve through a diplomatic means the recent security tensions between Turkey and Syria. The Astana talks, on Syria were launched in 2017 at the initiative of Iran, Russia, and Turkey. The presidents of the three guarantor states will hold their seventh summit in Tehran on Tuesday. Reports say that the Syrian foreign minister, Faisal Miqdad, is also due to arrive in Iran on the same day. And Shia Muslims in Iran and other countries are celebrating Eid al-Qadir, which is one of the main festivities on the Islamic calendar. That is the anniversary of the day Prophet Muhammad named his cousin and son-in-law, Ali ibn Abi Talib, as his successor and head of the Muslim community. Imam Ali, the first Shia imam, was named by the Prophet at a location outside Mecca called Qadir Qom. The occasion is marked every year at the end of the Hajj season. And parts of Europe remain on high alert amid rising temperatures that are expected to hit all-time highs as a heat wave moves north from continental Europe. The UK braces for its hottest day ever. The country could see temperatures near 40 degrees Celsius for the first time. That has affected all aspects of public life. Train services are suffering disruptions while schools and doctors' offices are closing and governments are urging people to work from home. The heat wave, also accompanied by wildfire crisis in France, firefighters are battling two gigantic blazes in the southwest, prompting the evacuation of another 5,000 people. Extreme heat has already been tormenting southern European countries like Spain and Portugal. Students have shown that climate change is making heat waves hotter, more frequent, and longer lasting. Our correspondent Chris Den Hund gives us more details on the measures taken by Western countries against the wildfire and heat wave in parts of Europe.
Experts, they said already that in the southwest of France, there is a drought since months, and there is already now a lack of water and a lack of quality and quantity of water. And there is also more serious critics coming from ecologic associations and opposition groups in the French parliament. They say that this kind of heat wave, does not have natural causes, but it's due to the human way of exploiting energy resources. So they are saying to the French authorities that France should stop taking half or zero measures against the global warming, and they are calling for a fast transition from the use of energy sources based on petrol and gas towards energy resources based on renewable energy, mm-hmm. Especially solar energy and wind energy. Germany is taking important measures for to make a transition to renewable energy. France is not very fast. Of course, it's better than the USA, who is totally, the political decision makers in the USA are totally linked to important big petrol companies.
That brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Economic Divide.
How much oil does the world use? Or a more appropriate question might be, how dependent is the world on oil? It has become apparent that it is quite a lot, given how the Ukraine conflict has affected energy prices. Hi, I'm Kavita Halfway. Welcome to another edition of Economic Divide. In this program, we will examine the West's dependence on oil and how U.S. sanctioned countries like Iran and Venezuela can make up some of the shortage. Coming up in today's program, the world guzzles up oil like you won't believe. The U.S. almost 20 million per day, the EU almost 17 million, and the world a whopping 97.10 million barrels per day. So is it a good idea to sanction countries that are major oil producers? Then the French President Emmanuel Macron has said to the U.S. the world needs oil from Iran and Venezuela to overcome a surge in fuel prices. But the U.S. is not listening, and therefore is shooting itself in the foot. Then the U.S. and now EU, so stubborn that they are shooting themselves in the foot by preventing oil-producing countries to sell their oil on the world market, even if it means that this would hurt their own economies. But for how long can they continue this path?
The war in Ukraine has triggered an unprecedented global energy crunch. Over the past few weeks, oil prices have risen to unprecedented levels and are likely to stay above there for months to come, even though the prices have come down below $100. Just recently, Germany's energy minister said the country needs to prepare for a possible escalation of problems in the gas market.
Dass es so, dass es eine weitere Reduktion gibt, muss man ehrlicherweise sagen, nein, das kann man natürlich nicht ausschließen. Wir haben das bei der Reduktion von Nord Stream 1 gesehen, dass technische Gründe vorgeschoben wurden. Und da sie einmal vorgeschoben wurden, kann das natürlich wieder passieren. Das ist jetzt inzwischen ja ein offenes Geheimnis. Und in einer Situation wie dieser kann man natürlich nichts ausschließen.
The situation is not better in the other Western nations either. The European gas market is currently experiencing a severe shortage of imported energy supplies. Deliveries by Russia's Gazprom through the Nord Stream pipeline have fallen to about 40% of capacity.
Europe seems or looks, appears weak on the gas front, so Russia might explore this weakness and send less gas to individual countries.
No doubt, the consumer-driven Western capitalistic society cannot and will not wean itself off of oil. It's addicted to oil, let's face it. But to prevent their own economies from advancing, well, that's what our focus is here in our social media section, especially when it comes to oil from countries like Russia, Iran, and Venezuela. Well, first stop, a warning from the Russian President Vladimir Putin. He sees catastrophic energy consequences for Europe as sanctions against his country continues.
Дальнейшее использование санкционной политики может привести к еще более тяжелым, без преувеличения, даже катастрофическим последствиям на мировом энергетическом рынке.
The next post shows the OPEC Secretary General Mohammad Barkindo, who said in a speech a few days ago that the global oil supply shortage can be eased if American sanctions on Iran and Venezuela are removed, and that the two countries can export more oil. Now, sadly, he passed away just days after making that statement. Now, this entry caught our attention, particularly since it was a press gaggle by Jake Sullivan en route to Madrid board Air Force One that happened on June 28th. The question was addressed to him, the U.S. National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan.
Jake, there was a video that came out yesterday from the G7 where President Macron is talking to both President Biden and yourself about Saudi Arabia, the fact that they're almost at max capacity and can't produce that much more oil. Does that change the president's thinking at all going into his trip next month? And did any other leaders approach him about his trip to Saudi Arabia?
I'm not going to characterize President Macron's comments yesterday.
Now, this was in reference to this tweet in which a desperate Emmanuel Macron confronts Biden at the G7 summit, insisting that pleas to Saudi Arabia, which can barely increase oil production, won't be enough. They've sanctioned the Russian oil. Now, their only hope is for heavily sanctioned Iran and Venezuela to export to Europe. Let me introduce our guest for this edition of our program. We have Ricardo Vaz joining us. He's a writer and editor at Venezuela Analysis, who joins us from Caracas. Ricardo Vaz, welcome to the program. When you take a look at how France is asking the U.S. president and in turn making a statement about the return of Iran and Venezuelan oil to the global oil market in order to ease the price rise that has occurred, that is something that the U.S. again seems to basically fall on deaf ears. Why do you think the U.S. is presenting this as an obstacle, refusing to cut back on the sanctions when it comes to Venezuela and Iran? I mean, isn't then the U.S. the cause of high energy prices and then not Russia because it has also sanctioned Russia?
Yeah, I think it's both ironic and hypocritical that after all these measures, unilateral measures from the United States to strangle essentially oil producers like Iran and Venezuela, now all of a sudden it finds itself in a position where it needs desperately for these countries to increase the supply to the global oil markets in order to reduce prices, which are affecting consumers both in the US and Europe and everywhere else. But yeah, as you mentioned, the biggest obstacle to increasing production, especially in Venezuela, which is the case that I know very well, is U.S. sanctions.
Okay, let's bring in Ranjit Brar, who's a political analyst, joining us from London. Ranjit Brar, welcome to Economic Divide. The world is dependent on oil from West Asia, or Middle East as it's called. That is not anything new. But the U.S. relationship with some of these countries at this point has frayed. The way that the U.S. president, for example, has carried on with Saudi Arabia, which in turn is obviously a country that influences OPEC a great deal. They have not listened to the U.S. request for an increase in oil production. Do you think then that because of this, the West is shooting itself in the foot by, for example, sanctioning Russia, carrying itself off the way it does with OPEC countries? I mean, why does the U.S. and the EU partners just continue down this path, do you think?
In a sense, they have no option. U.S. dollar is obviously the reserve currency of the world. The euro and the pound are the other reserve currencies of the world, to a large extent, perhaps the yen to an extent. These international tradable currencies have come off the back of an enormous agglomeration of wealth, of capital in those countries, which is to do with the entire colonial policy of those countries. Britain had an empire upon which the sun famously never set, and was directly superseded after World War II by the United States. Their entire economic hegemony has been predicated upon the military superiority, arrogating themselves the role of the global policeman, and they can't get out of that role.
It's time for InfoNews section of the program. This is where we take a look at economic news from around the world. Hopefully we have something in your part of the world. Well, first stop, sanctions, in particular sanctions on Russia. Now, the Russian President Vladimir Putin has warned sanctions risk energy price spike catastrophe. He goes on to say that Western calls to reduce reliance on Russian energy have made global markets spike in oil and gas. Russia is the largest supplier of gas to Europe, providing 40% of EU's gas. No surprise that the Russian president would issue such a warning. Not that the EU nor the U.S. is not aware of it. All right, next up, we're going to take a look at poverty. Yes, poverty, based on inflation, has plunged 71 million into poverty since the war in Ukraine started. So that's that shows the effect of the war in Ukraine. The UN Development Program report has found a surge in commodity prices hitting parts of the world's regions very hard. In terms of, if you're curious, in terms of which countries that is affected, we're looking at countries like Armenia, Uzbekistan, Burkina Faso, Ghana, Kenya, Rwanda, Sudan, and also Haiti, Pakistan, and Sri Lanka, just to name the few. I have a feeling that list is going to get extended. Next up, let's take a look at U.S. oil sales. We took a look at that first. The strategic oil reserves has gone abroad. That is the reason why we have focused on it, and I'll tell you why in a second. First of all, millions of barrels have been released, to lower domestic fuel prices, which were exported for the month of June. Now, what's interesting here is 5 million barrels were shipped to Italy, France, the Netherlands, India, and China. Can you guess why it's interesting? Because China is one of the destinations. I mean, U.S. selling oil to China doesn't make much sense, does it? That's probably good for another entire show to dedicate to that. Final stop, stagflation. That's right, stagflationary global debt crisis is looming, and things appear to be getting much worse based on that. Big economies such as the U.S. will face a recession and financial turmoil. Now, the next recession is going to be marked by a severe stagflationary debt crisis. So debt is intertwined with one of the reasons behind stagflation, as to why it's going to lead to that. Well, those were some of the topics we picked for this section of our program.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
It's time now for our in-depth section of the program. We want to focus in this section on the world's dependence on oil, especially their dependence on oil from West Asia and the top countries that actually guzzle that oil. What better way to do that than to look at the map? Here we have countries with the most oil, billion of barrels. Number one, Venezuela, 303 billion barrels, or a little over. Saudi Arabia coming in at number two, 258,000, a little over that. Iran at number 3, Iraq at number 4, Kuwait, and then UAE. We're looking, obviously, at West Asia and how much of the oil is controlled in terms of the production. And then Russia and the U.S. is noteworthy to point out here also in terms of their oil reserves. Now, the reason why we're looking at that is obviously to show how much focus, as I just mentioned, comes or is focused on the oil that's produced and has in reserves, in this case, on countries in West Asia. Next up is how we need to look at the top oil-producing countries in order to get a synop. Now, again, Venezuela, 304 billion barrels. Number 2, Saudi Arabia, which has 298 billion barrels. Canada, in this case, we've mentioned Canada because sources do not have Canada actually in the top 4. But we figured that it's appropriate to put that because more sources outweigh the fact that Canada is in the top 4 producing oil countries. And then number 4 is allocated to Iran, which has 156 billion barrels. And these are the countries with the most oil, okay? So now we have to take a look at the share of the global oil reserves broken down in percentage. This is important. You have basically a division made between OPEC countries at the top and the non-OPEC countries at the bottom. So the OPEC countries, again, it's a reflection of what we just covered, but you have Venezuela, 17.8% of the oil reserves of the of the total world supply, Saudi Arabia, 17.2%, and then you have, for example, Iran at 9%, and then Iraq at 8.4%. And then at the bottom half, you have non-OPEC countries such as Russia, Canada, China, the U.S., Kazakhstan. And combined, we're looking at 93.5% of the known oil reserves that are in these top 14 countries. So that's important for us in the bigger picture that we are outlining for you over here. Next up is how we are going to take a look at the way that the consumption is now on the oil from these countries. We looked at 3 geographic areas. First, the U.S. comes in at 19.78 million barrels. Now, this is per day. Next, the EU, just shy of about 17 million barrels of oil per day. And then finally, you have the world consumption itself as a whole, which is almost at 100 million barrels per day. 97.1 million barrels of oil is consumed in the world. Now, when you take a look at the percentage coming from West Asia, in terms of the number of countries, it was about 5 or 6 that are in the top producing countries. How dependent then the world is, and in particular, a country like the U.S. and an area like the EU when it comes to their dependence. So I don't think that the U.S. or the EU can actually afford to play hardball when it comes to Russia or sanctioning out Iran and Venezuela's oil. All right, let's find out what our guest thinks about this. Ricardo Vaz rejoins us. He's a writer and editor at Venezuela's Analysis, who rejoins us from Caracas. Ricardo Vaz, welcome back. The world is dependent on oil from the West Asia region, or Middle East, as it's called in other publications. But the U.S. relationship with these countries, in some sense, has frayed. At this point, OPEC is not really even listening, led by Saudi Arabia, to U.S. demands to increase its output based on the latest that we have in order to offset these high energy prices. Why does the U.S. and its EU partners, led by the U.S. In this case, continue down this path of self-destruction when it comes to sanctioning countries such as, for example, Iran or Venezuela or also Russia?
I think mostly the U.S. and, of course, its allies are then forced to fall in line, kind of wants to have it both ways. So in a way, capitalist development in the West has always relied on cheap commodities and in particular fuel and oil. And at the same time, the U.S. wants to use sanctions as a way to pressure, I mean, it's a very mild way of saying it, as a way to trigger regime change.
All right. Well, let's find out what Ranjit Brar thinks. He's a political analyst who rejoins us from London. Ranjit Brar, welcome back. One U.S. think tank I'd like to get your idea on, who has said that the only way that consumers can check West Asia's influence is by the U.S. and the West actually basically pursuing or putting their collective weight together in order to act in a unified manner, as they have put it. And they want to do that in order to counterbalance OPEC, and they want to shift to alternatives. That's been one of their main goals. In order to, adopt policies conducive to energy security. But we've heard that notion before, but they've been unable to do that because of their addiction to oil. Is that a correct strategy, or is it just confrontational in terms of the way that they're demanding, in a sense, for OPEC to increase production?
It's both confrontational and it's counterproductive, but it's the only strategy in their playbook. So, you know, the whole invasion of Iraq, the fermentation of the Iran-Iraq war, the invasion of Syria and the division of Syria, all of these are aimed at essentially occupying and controlling Middle Eastern oil reserves. But they've failed, and in particular with the rise of China as an economic power, with the Belt and Road Initiative, with more and more countries no longer willing to dance to the Americans' tune, that moment of unipolar hegemony that United States experienced following the collapse of the Soviet Union seems to be very much a thing of the past. And countries, even, you know, Saudi Arabia, which is, you know, America considers its own vassal state, is refusing to dance to the economic tune of the United States. What we're seeing is the rise of a multipolar world. We're seeing the relative decline of the United States and Europe, and along with that, the ending of the period when United States could manipulate the global currency market and use the dollar in order to sabotage the economies of other countries. When they tried to do that with Russia, when they sanctioned $300 billion of its foreign reserve assets held under their banking system, they found they bit off more they can chew. They failed to destroy Russia. On the contrary, their sanctions against Russia are backfiring, and more countries now are looking to break free of the economic stranglehold that was formerly exercised upon them.
Both Iran and Venezuela have been under severe U.S. sanctions. Just recently, they signed a 20-year cooperation deal to expand their ties in various fields, including oil and gas.
We will witness how the new world will take shape and how we will stand up to problems and secure progress. Iranian and Venezuelan youth should know that the future world will enjoy equality and justice, and that we will stand up to imperialism.
Experts believe extra supply from Iran will be vital to resolving the global energy crisis, as Venezuela's ability to pump additional oil to the markets has been hampered by U.S. sanctions.
When it comes to the price of oil, there has been a drop in oil prices in the recent days. Although that might sound that it is good news, it's really not the case. Fears of an abrupt weakening of economic growth have been building over the past week. This was reflected in the past in what is called a U.S. yield curve. It has preceded recessions in the past. The Russophobia sentiment by the U.S. and Western countries has continued unabated, and one display occurred at the G7 summit. This is what the Russian FM said about the U.S.
No, it was not us who abandoned all contacts. It was the United States. That's all I can say. And we are not running after anybody suggesting meetings. If they don't want to talk, it's their choice.
And as stated before, it remains illogical, the U.S. then, the European approach toward Russia, when so much of Russian oil, for example, is purchased by Europe. This chart shows just how dependent not only Europe, but the world is on Russian oil. The Netherlands, Germany, Poland, Italy, and the UK are just some of the European countries who are buyers of Russian oil. And what is worse is that when sanctions backfire, the EU doesn't have a plan for life without cheap Russian energy. So what happens next, as stated here, it refers to how Germany has reported its first trade deficit in 30 years. It states that the prospects for West European industry look grim thanks to the US-led sanctions on Russia. Meanwhile, the U.S. Russophobia at the G20 summit was extended to China. It actually issued a warning against China during more than 5 hours of talks with Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi, in which he raised concerns over Beijing's alignment with Moscow.
I shared again with State Councilor that we are concerned about the PRC's alignment with Russia. Now, what you hear from Beijing is that it claims to be neutral. I would start with the proposition that it's pretty hard to be neutral when it comes to this aggression. There's a clear aggressor, there's a clear victim, there's a clear challenge not only to the lives and livelihoods of people in Ukraine, but there's a challenge to the international order.
Which brings us to the final piece, and that is U.S. President Joe Biden's upcoming visit to West Asia, where it is widely speculated he will make up with Saudi Arabia to get more oil out of the pariah nation, as he called it. Of course, he rejects that notion.
I guess I will see the king and the crown prince, but that's not the meeting I'm going to. They'll be part of a much larger meeting. No, I'm not going to ask. I'm going to ask. All the Gulf states are meeting. I indicated to them that I thought they should be increasing oil production generically, not to the Saudis particularly.
So you see, you sanction countries like Venezuela and Iran so you can go and plead with a human rights violator which assassinates the opposition and Palestinian journalists. Go figure. That does it for this segment of the program. Hope you enjoyed it.
The U.S. President Joe Biden wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post recently. In it, he said, the region, the West Asia region, remains full of challenges, like Iran. Just a few sentences later, he said, still, compared to 18 months ago, the region is less pressurized and more integrated. That's about the length of time that the Iranian president started his tenure. If only the U.S. stayed out of the region and stopped sanctioning countries, especially oil-producing ones, then there wouldn't be this energy crunch in some sense. At least it would be less of it. That does it for this edition of the program. It was great having you with us, as usual. From Mikhail Tahwe and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
Ocean of Dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we'll have a glance at Kumail's supplication and we'll discuss a commentary on that. We'll be back in a few seconds, so stay tuned. وليت شعري يا سيدي وإلهي ومولاي أتسلط النار على وجوه خرت لعظمتك ساجدا وعلى ألسن نطقت بتوحيدك صادقا بشكرك مادحا وعلى قلوب اعترفت بإلهيتك محققا وعلى ضمائر حوت من العلم بك حتى صارت خاشعة وعلى جوارح سعت إلى أوطان تعبدك طائعة
As you were previously with us, dear listeners, we were discussing this excerpt of the Kumail supplication. وَلَيْتَ شِعْرِي يَا سَيِّدِي وَإِلَهِي وَمَوْلَايِ أَتُسَلِّطُ النَّارَ عَلَى وُجُوهٍ خَرَّتْ لِعَظَمَتِكَ سَاجِدَةٍ Would that I knew, O my Master, my Allah, my Protector, whether you will give the fire dominion over faces fallen down, prostrating before your greatness. وَعَلَىٰ أَلْسُنٍ نَطَقَتْ بِتَوْحِيدِكَ صَادِقَ The tongues voicing sincerely the profession of your oneness. وَبِشُكْرِكَ مَادِحَ the tongues giving thanks to you in praise. وَعَلَىٰ قُلُوبٍ اَعْتَرَفَتْ بِإِلَٰهِيَّتِكَ مُحَقِّقَةً The hearts acknowledging your divinity through verification. وَعَلَىٰ ضَمَائِرَ حَوَتْ مِنَ الْعِلْمِ بِكَ حَتَّى صَارَتْ خَاشِعَةً Or the minds encompassing knowledge of you until they have become humble. وَعَلَىٰ جَوَارِحَ سَعَتْ إِلَىٰ أَوْطَانِ تَعَبُّدِكَ طَائِعَةً وَأَشَارَتْ بِاسْتِغْفَارِكَ مُذْعِنَةً And the limbs speeding to the places of your worship in obedience and entreating your forgiveness in submission. مَا هَكَذَا ظَنُّ بِكَ No such opinion cannot be held of you. وَلَا أُخْبِرْنَا بِفَضْلِكَ عَنْكَ يَا كَرِيمُ يَا رَبْ Nor has such been reported thanks to your bounty concerning you, O Allah, the generous. About this part of the supplication that the commander of the believers states the different states of the one who is worshipping Allah in its most comprehensive form, which is prayer. We had a quick look at some of the traditions upon the importance of prayer. This prayer, if experienced with love of Allah, the owner cannot ever doubt about the forgiveness of the Almighty Allah. The one who has experienced the love of Allah within himself cannot ever doubt this, because it is possible that a servant may show negligence in obeying Allah practically at some time, and sometimes he may embark onto something which is disliked by Allah. But that which is unimaginable, even while he is indulged in the wrongdoing, is his dislike for Allah's obedience and his love for sinning. This is unimaginable for a true servant. That is why the servant is always sure of the mercy of the Almighty Allah, of the forgiveness in hereafter, and at the same time, he's scared because he might have had some shortcomings, some wrongdoings.
I wish I had known, O my Master, my God and my Lord. Will you inflict fire upon faces which have submissively bowed in your prostration to your greatness, or upon the tongues which have sincerely confirmed your unity and have always expressed gratitude to you? Or upon hearts which have acknowledged your divinity with conviction, or upon the minds which accumulated so much knowledge of you until they became submissive to you, or upon the limbs which strove to the places appointed for your worship, to adore you willingly and seek your forgiveness submissively. Such harshness is not expected from you, as it is far from your grace. O generous one, O Lord, you are aware of my weakness to bear even a minor affliction of this world and its consequence and adversity, although such afflictions are momentary, short-lived and transient.
Thank you, Allah. So good about all the things that we went through, knowing that God is pleased with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true, and we know we'll be here forever. The feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
The ocean of dua.
So he has belief in his heart. His heart is totally embracing the cognition of the Almighty Allah. It is very interesting that Imam Ali alayhi salam tells this very Kumail, the narrator of this Kumail's application, Ya Kumail, laysa sha'nu an tusalli wa tasuma wa tatasaddaq. O Kumail, you should not merely perform prayer, fast and pay charity. Innama sha'n an takuna salata فعلت بقلب نقي وعمل عند الله مرضي وخشوع سوي. Rather, you should perform prayer with a purified and humble heart to satisfy Allah. And this is the kind of salat that not just the man or woman who is praying, but all the body parts, the clothes, and everything around the worshipper are also worshipping. إن الإنسان, Imam Ali alayhi salam says, إذا كان في الصلاة فإن جسده وثيابه وكل شيء حوله يسبح. When one is performing prayer, his body, his clothes, everything around him, they're all worshipping. And besides the Holy Quran, the reliable Shi'i tradition sources, like Wasail al-Shi'a, are the best and most complete sources about the worldly and heavenly effects of performing this comprehensive form of worshipping, which is prayer. The true salat is the one that both the bodily parts and the soul, they're in one direction. These two are both paying their full attentions. They have their focuses to the Almighty Allah. And this is the split between the bodily instruments and the instruments of the soul. We have Jawarih and Jawanih. Jawanih are the instruments of the soul, and Jawarih are the bodily instruments, the organs. The bodily parts sometimes fail to accompany the instruments of the heart, but the Jawanih of the righteous ones solely belong to Allah. They always succumb to the love of Allah, and no one and nothing else. That is why in one of the supplications we read, O Allah, I love obeying you even though I have fallen short of it, and I dislike disobeying you even though I have embarked on it. So be gracious to me in granting me the heaven. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Don't let me go astray, cause I need you by my side. I wish to be close to you through half my life. Ya Allah, oh Allah, be with me.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.